Welcome to the Exec MBA Podcast. I'm your host, Brett Twitty, and you are listening to a new episode. On this episode of the podcast, I'm excited to share my recent conversation, Perry Canaria. Perry is a first-year student in our Executive MBA class of 2022, and he and I recently connected via Zoom to talk about his MBA journey, what led him to Darden, how things are going in his first year, and so much more. I think you're really going to enjoy this conversation. So without further ado, here's my interview with Perry Canaria. Perry, welcome to the podcast.
Morning, Brett. How are you?
It's great to see you. How are you doing?
Well, you know, I'm surviving. It's just been a very interesting time for everybody, as you know. But I think as far as the events of last year go, I think the worst is definitely behind us, and I'm looking for brighter days ahead. I'm getting my COVID vaccine this week, so hopefully that's a sign of, you know, how we're heading in the right direction now.
Well, congratulations. That's very exciting. Have you picked up any hobbies, anything that you're enjoying doing with maybe a little bit more free time here?
Well, I'll tell you, I haven't picked up any new hobbies, but I've gotten a chance to revisit old hobbies. As you know, from our interview last year, I had been playing classical piano for 15 years in my previous life. And, you know, once you start a family and have kids and work picks up, a lot of those old hobbies and interests, just they kind of fall by the wayside. And with the pandemic and travel plans on hold and really everyone sheltering in place, it's been a nice opportunity for me to dust off a lot of those old piano books and relearn some of those scores. So that's been you know, there have been a few positive outcomes from the pandemic, and that for me personally has been one of them.
Well, you got to tell us, what are you playing on the piano these days?
Well, you know, one of my favorite pieces was the Italian Concerto by Bach. I used to know that, I had that memorized, start to finish way back in college, and, it's a very technical piece. If you like Baroque music, it's a really nice piece, that he wrote. I relearned that, some Chopin Polonaises, A flat major was one of my favorites. I'm kind of working through that again. And, Those have taken quite a bit of time, actually. You know, you lose a lot of the muscle memory that you took for granted at a time when I was much younger. But it comes back with a little bit of practice, and patience requires a lot of patience.
Well, that's just good for life in general. I would say to have the opportunity to practice patience. It's interesting. Patience is like a muscle. The more you use it, the more you sort of stress it, the better you can get at being a patient person. There's lots of scientific studies to suggest.
Absolutely. This. Absolutely.
Well, it's great to see you here, Perry. And just occasionally here on the podcast, things come full circle where I have a chance to talk with someone that I had the good fortune of interviewing through our admissions process. And as you already alluded to, I got a chance to interview you when you were going through the application process. But for our listeners, they haven't had a chance to hear your story. So let's start off, just talk a little bit more about your background. Who are you? What are you doing currently? And then what did you do before coming to Darden?
Okay, sure. So as far as brief biography goes, I grew up in a small town called Danville, Pennsylvania, about 3 hours north of here. I went to Bucknell University for college, where I was a pre-med double major in biology and English. Went on from there to Philadelphia, where I lived for 4 years in medical school, and then moved to Boston, where I spent the next 7 years finishing up my medical residency and a fellowship in 2005. At that point, we moved back down here to Northern Virginia to be closer to family and to start our own family, and have been here ever since.
All right. And what are you doing currently? What does your work look like on a day in, day out basis?
Sure. So by training, I'm a neuroradiologist, which means that I specialize in interpreting medical imaging scans, like MRIs and CAT scans of the brain and spine. So that in my professional capacity as a doctor, that's my specialty. Previously, I worked in an academic setting in Boston, and then I was in private practice here in the Reston area for a few years. Currently, I work as an independent contractor for a large teleradiology company, providing remote telemedicine type services for hospitals and medical facilities across the country. So that's my current job right now.
I imagine that keeps you pretty busy. What do your days look like?
So I work really unusual hours. So as far as teleradiology goes, one of the biggest advantages is having the flexibility and luxury from working from home. So, you know, working from home is a new concept for a lot of people. Over the last year, the pandemic has kind of forced people to be able to reinvent their careers from their home offices. I've been doing this since 2007. So for me, this is just another day at work. The drawback is that there's always a cost, right? The flexibility is one thing, but the price I pay is I work very unusual hours, typically in the middle of the night. I'm starting around 2 or 3 in the morning. But the nice thing about those hours is I'm usually done by 10 or 11 o'clock in the morning before lunchtime. So it gives me a couple hours during the day while the kids are still at school to run personal errands, go to the gym, catch up on my academics. So unusual hours, but they seem to work pretty well for me and for us as a family at this point in my life.
I imagine getting onto that schedule, though, took some adjustment. What was that like?
You know, I've been lucky, you know, dating back to medical school, I've been lucky in that I typically only need about 5-6 hours of sleep tops to function normally. So I think genetically I have an advantage that I can have that kind of a weird schedule and not be too affected by it. Of course, every now and then I'll need an afternoon nap to kind of catch up on sleep. But from a physical standpoint, it hasn't been that hard. I will say, as I get older, you know, being able to shift back and forth from a normal routine to my work routine, it gets a little more challenging. But so far, I've been able to pull it off without any major problems.
So you're here on the Executive MBA podcast. I wonder, you know, as a doctor, obviously you've already been to a lot of school. What led you to start thinking about an MBA? How did this get on your radar?
You know, I had always been fascinated by the world of business, rather. You know, from an outsider's perspective, it always struck me as this very interesting, complex, dynamic, competitive playing field, I guess, for lack of a better term, where in order to succeed, you needed to have this very multi-dimensional skill set that required this blend of a practical understanding of mathematical and statistical concepts as they pertain to things like accounting and finance, and then being able to apply those concepts in the context of, say, a medical practice, for example, or a small company, and then expand that understanding to that of a larger corporation or a national economy or a global marketplace. And what's fascinating is, you know, you have all those dense quantitative skills. But what fascinated me even further was just being able to take that material and that knowledge, and then within that, learning how to incorporate this whole appreciation of the art of leadership, I guess, and understanding how to be an effective leader requires being a good listener, a persuasive communicator. So that you can take all that data, all that information, all that quantitative knowledge, and then kind of synthesize it and then deliver it to an audience with finesse, right? If you look at, like, the greatest business leaders out there, they've somehow mastered that very multidimensional skill set. And it's interesting. A lot of the most interesting people that I've met, whether it's in a social setting or at work, that embody that skill set, curiously enough, a lot of them come from the world of business, and many of those people have MBAs. And so I realized very quickly that it couldn't just be a coincidence. There's something going on here. And I've always wanted to have that skill set. And from a physician's perspective, those skills aren't typically taught in medical school. And they're definitely difficult to acquire in everyday medical practice. So that always, you know, there's always this lingering curiosity to kind of, you know, dip my toe in that water, and then just kind of get a sense of, you know, is this something for me? And Brett, as you know, modern healthcare delivery systems are enormously complex businesses, right? Where a lot of high level discussions are made by non-physicians with little physician input. And because of that, I always felt that as a profession, doctors could become truly empowered, I guess, by learning how to speak the language of business and understanding the economic realities that go into making a lot of these healthcare policy decisions. You know, I've been to so many medical staff meetings where the doctors and administrators hit this impasse, right? Communication breaks down. There's a lot of mistrust on both ends. And I really, having witnessed that, I believe that, you know, physicians who understand the business side of medicine become more credible. They're better able to advocate for themselves because they're finally able to engage in meaningful discussions with non-physicians. So I felt that, you know, I said, the more I thought about it, I realized, you know, getting an MBA would be the perfect bridge there. It would help me become a better communicator, learn a skill set that I was probably not going to learn in my current capacity, and empower myself and my whole profession.
It's really interesting to hear you make all of those points. I also think a lot about, I mean, I'm sure there are other times in our nation's history when we have talked a lot about healthcare, but man, it seems like the past 10 plus years, certainly since the Obama administration and the Affordable Care Act, there has been a tremendous amount of attention on healthcare delivery, access to healthcare, the cost of healthcare, the amount of the GDP that is spent on healthcare. It seems to me, as an outsider, you work in it every day, but that it's an industry where there's just a lot going on, and it possibly in the midst of a transformation and maybe a lot of opportunity as well.
Well, absolutely, at every level. And I think with COVID and the pandemic, it's really forced everyone to really reinvent themselves in any field that you may be in within medicine. A lot of the cases that we've studied at Darden are directly related to the impact of COVID on multiple different industries, including healthcare. And I think, and that's one thing that I really like about the Darden curriculum. It doesn't just go, you're not just presented with old dated cases. A lot of the material we're going over is current and directly relevant to what's happening in the world today. And a lot of those trends and forces are affecting the healthcare system as well.
One of the things that was interesting to me is a storyline about sort of healthcare's response to COVID-19 is the adoption of telehealth. This is one of these things that, at least my sort of layperson understanding, is that it was going to be very challenging. One of these projects that had been discussed and maybe put off for another day, and then all of a sudden, here you are, and that's the safest option for people, and now we have telehealth.
Yeah, and it's interesting, you know, like you said, a lot of these things were probably going to happen eventually, but with COVID, it just, you know, people were forced to reinvent themselves, figure out how we're going to make this work. And I think people are realizing, patients especially, it just makes a lot of sense at so many levels, right? The old days of scheduling an appointment with your doctor, taking off from work, driving through traffic to get to the hospital, navigating through the parking lot, getting your parking ticket, going to the waiting room, sitting in the waiting room with, you know, 15 other sick people with coughs and colds and sneezes and fevers to see the doctor. People are realizing all that can be done from the comfort of your home, because a lot of these issues, remember, Brett, can be dealt with very easily through video conferencing or Zoom. They don't necessarily require seeing a doctor in person. So I think now that COVID forced everybody to consider that as a new modality, a new way to see your physician, it just makes sense at so many levels. Of course, you know, if you have an acute problem and the doctor needs to examine you, you know, there's still no replacing. You need to see the doctor in person or go to the emergency room. But a lot of the healthcare that's delivered is routine follow-up type care that can easily be done in a remote setting context. I mean, my field lends itself pretty well to telemedicine type services. I've been reading scans remotely since 2007, but that's because my field happens to be imaging based. You know, I can provide teleradiology services for a hospital in Alaska with the same level of quality as I can for one just around the corner here in Virginia. So my field lends itself to remote providing services remotely. But I think a lot of the fields where there's more direct patient to doctor communication, they're also realizing that a lot of what they do can also be done in the remote context.
It's very interesting. How did Darden get on your radar? What led you to Darden?
So with my pre-existing fascination with the whole concept of business school, I had always, even before I moved to Virginia, I knew that Darden had a consistently strong academic reputation among the top business schools in the country. Over the past couple years, when I started revisiting the topic of possibly getting an executive MBA, I started doing more research about Darden specifically. And it's interesting, I kept hearing a lot of the current students and alumni use the term Darden journey or Darden transformation. And I started getting the sense that, okay, you know, the whole Darden experience seems more than just like this transactional experience where you pay your tuition, you check the boxes, you learn all the technical skills, and then you get your diploma, and then you move on. It just seemed, the word transformation kept reoccurring. People kept, you know, when they talked about their Darden, their time at Darden, I heard metamorphosis, transformation, people saying that they were a completely different person the day they graduated than when they entered the program. And at that point in my life, I needed a change. Transformation for me was definitely in order. So that really resonated with me. I had always had this lingering concern that as a physician, that I would be coming from a very non-traditional background with no formal business training. And I felt that that would be a big liability. You know, what could a doctor possibly contribute to the business school classroom? But it's interesting, as I spoke to more people about Darden, it became very clear that there's no one right background to come from. There's no one predetermined path to get here. A lot of people describe Darden as being a place where you just show up as who you are, the skills that you've acquired from whatever industry you come from, and you know that you're there to engage in some kind of process of self-discovery, self-reflection, and you realize that everyone there is approaching it with the same hesitation, the same insecurities. You know, they're all kind of the term imposter syndrome, like, well, what possibly can I contribute to this level of learning? But when you realize that everyone is there with similar concerns and similar insecurities and similar hesitations, it just makes the whole process a lot easier. Now, I just want to be clear, I still get intimidated by a lot of my, how intelligent and successful and smart a lot of my classmates are, but Darden has created a very safe place for somebody like me who comes from a non-traditional background to venture out of my pre-existing comfort zone, which, by the way, was very small. There's a very small space where doctors feel comfortable, and anything beyond the world of medicine just is this foreign concept. But Darden's been a great place for me to kind of stray to the very edges of that comfort zone and learn new things and put myself out there and be vulnerable without risking complete and, you know, immediate self-destruction. And, you know, the longer that I'm here, I realize that everyone is at different stages of that self-discovery process. So for all those reasons, Darden seemed to be the best fit for me.
I appreciate your points around imposter syndrome. I think it's something that all MBA students wrestle with, whether you choose the full-time residential path or you're doing the executive MBA program. I think there is that moment where people are like, how did I get into this class, it was somehow that you snuck in? And we think it's so important, and I appreciate your mentioning it here. We think it's so important for people to know that everyone has earned their spot in class, that they're here for a reason, that you were chosen by the admissions committee because of the background and experiences that you had, you know, your desire to pursue this, what you're going to bring to the program. And our goal as admissions committee is to have as many different people as possible in the classroom. And I wonder, what's your learning experience been like thus far? I mean, it's case method, right? So you've got a fair number of doctors in your class, but you have a number of other people from different backgrounds too.
Yeah, so the case method, to be honest with you, Brett, I thought that that type of learning was going to be very intimidating for me, and it is, you know, frankly, to be completely honest, it is a very intimidating way to learn, only because as a physician, most physicians come from a very different type of learning background, right? Medical school, you're given vast quantities of information to learn, and a lot of it involves just rote memorization. You just memorize as much as you can, you spit it out on the exam, and then you memorize a whole bunch of other stuff, and you spit that out on another exam, and the process keeps repeating. And in medical school, you know, we get good at, or at least I got good at figuring out, okay, if I want to learn this quantity of material, I need to spend X amount of time learning it, and then I would reap this amount of return. Right, and I was pretty good at figuring that out. With the case method, you could spend hours and hours and hours trying to sift through the material, and you'll never master it. And I had to get used to the fact that because the issues we're learning about, the concepts we're learning about are so complicated, I could spend a good day or two trying to get through a case, but invariably I'll probably show up to class not having mastered it. And that was very difficult for me because as a perfectionist, I'm very reluctant entering any kind of discussion unless I know that I've mastered the material, unless I know that I know everything 100% backward, forward, inside out. I am very reluctant to engage in kind of discussion about that topic. Now, that's a fault, I admit. It's not a very good quality to have when you're pursuing another secondary degree. So one thing that, you know, as in terms of how I've changed, I'm getting better at realizing that meaningful discussions don't require a mastery of the topic being discussed. I'm still working on it. I haven't perfected that. I think the case method has really helped me understand that, look, it's perfectly fine knowing 60% of the material, understanding maybe half of it. You've given it your all. There's still a lot you don't understand, but that doesn't mean that you show up to class and just kind of sit in the corner and let everybody else talk. It's okay to kind of stick your neck out and say something. You may think it makes, you know, you may think it sounded stupid, but at no point have I ever felt that I've said something in class and others were thinking, oh gosh, you know, how did this guy get into this program? It's a very forgiving place to be, a very safe place to learn.
You're right. It's all part of the learning process. And you make such a good point about sort of getting comfortable with being uncomfortable, I guess is the one way to think about it, that kind of vulnerability or kind of pushing outside of your comfort zone is necessary for transformational learning. That self-awareness, just to say, like, look, I have this tendency to feel like I have to know everything in order to contribute. And in business, you're never going to have perfect information. There's always going to be things that you want to know more about. And you have to figure out, okay, it's an ambiguous situation. There's no right answer. We've got the information we have. What decisions should we make and why? And I think that's really what the case method is all about.
Absolutely. And it's so different from the way I learned in medical school. I'm excited. I'm excited to become better and more proficient at the case method. And understand what you just said, that look, there's oftentimes no right answer. You just do the best you can with the information at hand, and then you just hope for the best. And that being said, I will say, Brett, that whenever I'm overwhelmed with the amount of work and I think about how much I don't understand, I kind of step back, take a deep breath, and look back at myself just a few months ago. I was at in August. I mean, Brett, my wife is also a physician, and she would occasionally ask me in years past to help her go through the financial statements of her practice. She's in a small medical practice, and she would show me a balance sheet, an income statement, and it was like I was reading Greek. I had no idea what I was looking at. And here we are just 4 or 5 months later, and we've looked at financial statements for companies like Boeing and Target and banks like Wells Fargo. And once you're thrown in that situation where you have to figure it out and learn to navigate through all those numbers, now when I look at my wife's practice statements, it's like child's play. It's a piece of cake. So at moments like that, I say, okay, look, there's a lot that I need to learn, but I've definitely learned a lot in just 4 months. And I'm excited to see how much more I'm going to change in the next 15, 16 months.
Your point there is such a good one, that you do have to find ways to both recognize what you've achieved and celebrate that as you go through the program, because you're going to be so busy, have a lot going on, that just taking that moment to pause and say, man, I have learned a ton. There's still a lot I don't know, but I've made it through accounting or finance or global economics, decision analysis, wherever you are in the curriculum. And I can do this now. I can look at a balance sheet. I can look at an income statement, or I now have a perspective on something I did not have a perspective on previously. Finding those ways to celebrate those accomplishments, very, very important in a working professional program.
Absolutely.
So you're now in quarter three. Quarter three is, for your class, a very busy quarter. You have accounting, finance, and leadership communications. A lot going on. How's it going?
Well, if you said it perfectly, it is a very busy quarter. I think the analogy that we hear a lot of drinking from a fire hose resonates very deeply this quarter. It's certainly been a lot of work. It's manageable. But it definitely requires you to depend on your learning teammates, other classmates. There, back to what we were just talking about, there's a way to master all of this material on your own. You really need to divide and conquer. And in that regard, I've been very lucky with a great learning team, great classmates, always able to bounce ideas off of, discuss topics. A lot of our classmates have been very generous with their time doing voluntary tutorials. We have some very talented accountants, for example, that spend their own free time doing Zoom tutorials for the rest of us, for whom accounting is a new concept. So it's a lot of work. It's a lot of concepts and material that's completely new to me, but the way the program is set up and the personalities of the people in my class, it all lends itself to a very collective, communal learning effort where everyone gets through the work. We're all going to survive, and we're all in it together. And at no point do I ever feel like, oh my gosh, I'm the only one struggling. You know, we're all, I guess the term struggling has a negative connotation. I'm not the only one that's overwhelmed. Everyone is feeling super busy. You know, we're doing an academic curriculum with a full-time job. Many of us have kids. Several people have aging parents, and so people have a lot on their plate, but we're all managing and enjoying ourselves while we're doing it.
I want to ask you a little bit more about the experience thus far. So one of the things that we have really remarked upon as an admissions team, as a program team, is the extent to which your class found ways to be engaged with each other. Even though, you know, beginning March of last year, we weren't able to do in-person activities. We did a bunch of online virtual events. We had virtual meetups. Y'all had your own virtual happy hours that you scheduled, all sorts of other things. We had virtual first coffee. We had mock classes, tons of things going on. And man, it felt like y'all showed up to orientation LR1, possibly as the most connected class we had ever had thus far in the program. I mean, do you want to talk a little bit about your classmates and what you've done?
Yeah, no, I think it's a perfect example of when life gives you a lemon, the best approach is to make lemonade, right? And I've been very fortunate classmates that have that are very talented with technology. Instantly, back in July, a large WhatsApp chat group was immediately set up, and it was just a buzz with activity and people getting to know one another through that context. And I think it's really, this whole pandemic has really forced everyone to think creatively outside the box and say, okay, look, these are our limitations. These are the things that are beyond our control. How can we make the most of this experience with the resources at hand? And Brett, to be honest with you, I mean, at least we have these modalities to stay in touch, right? I mean, Zoom, WhatsApp, all these things, they weren't available, you know, just a couple of years ago. So if the pandemic hit back in 2005, I just wonder, you know, what would have happened? I mean, it would have really shut down a lot of these people's desires and dreams to pursue something like an executive MBA. You know, we're lucky that we have something to fall back on in terms of staying in touch. And I think so one of the positive outcomes of this whole predicament has been the fact that we started on the first day of LR1 almost feeling like we knew each other pretty well. You know, you get a sense of people's personalities even through things like WhatsApp and texting and instant messaging. So in that sense, I think we started the very first day already having connected at some level. Of course, there's no replacing in-person interactions. And I think Darden has done a great job of balancing student health, student safety, with preserving as much of the experience as possible for us. We've had in-person sessions. Those on-ground residencies have been done in person when possible. And I think, you know, having spoken to other people out there and having seen how, with my own children, how different elementary schools, high schools have approached distance learning and seeing how some schools have done things well and how others haven't through my kids, I can say without a doubt that Darden has done a tremendous job of maintaining, you know, working within all the constraints and limitations that everyone is limited by and still preserving as much of that real life experience as possible.
So one of the paths for doctors is to do an MBA that's very healthcare focused. And you've chosen a path that's very general management. We do have healthcare electives, and you've talked about some of the cases that you've read so far that have a healthcare flavor or focus to them. But I wonder, you know, how did you decide that you wanted to do this more general management path?
Well, you know, I think, well, this goes back to my decision to approach, to pursue an MBA. For a long time, I delayed the decision because I felt like I didn't have one clear-cut answer as to why I wanted to pursue an MBA. And in retrospect, that was wrong. I would run the whole idea by colleagues and family members and friends, and they would invariably say, well, you know, what exactly do you want to do with an MBA? And because I had no compelling, jaw-dropping, single, well-mapped-out answer to that question, I felt that, okay, so I can't answer that question. There's really no point for me to do this. Then I realized that, look, you know, I don't have to have it all figured out right now. I had spoken to enough people that said, look, just take a leap of faith and accept that there are opportunities out there that you may not even be aware of. And if you're willing to take that leap of faith and approach an executive MBA program with a blank canvas, clean slate, and leave every opportunity on the table, the amount of transformation that you could potentially experience is unlimited. And so I wanted to keep every option open. And I thought that a general approach to this program would serve me well. I'm very fortunate in that my particular field of medicine is technology-based, so there's a lot of exciting technology being developed out there with regard to artificial intelligence and its applications to medical imaging. There are a lot of startups out there based on AI and its applications to medicine. A lot of entrepreneurial opportunities in that field. There's no shortage of management positions that are looking for doctors with medical experience and on top of that, some business skills to fill those positions. So because there are many different possibilities or many possible outcomes for me, I thought that approaching this with as broad of a perspective as possible would probably be the best idea, as opposed to coming in with just this strict, like, I want to become the CMO of a company, or I only want to do medical entrepreneurship. I said, you know what? Those all sound interesting to me. I haven't ruled out anything at this point. Let me just go with a general approach, learn as much as I can, and figure it out as I go along. Well, the analogy I use for a lot of my doctor friends is, you know, most people that go to medical school don't know on day one that they want to be a pediatric neurosurgeon, right? They say, okay, look, you know, I like surgery. But whether that means orthopedic surgery or, you know, that I'll figure that out later. You kind of go in with some general interest, keep your mind open, and don't make any decisions too early, and then see where life takes you. So that's where I'm at. I'm kind of approaching it with leaving every option on the table and then seeing where the interests fall as time goes on.
Well, Perry, I wonder if you have a piece of advice for our prospective student listeners, something that you would highlight for them based upon your experience.
I mean, I could give you several bits of advice. I mean, I think one thing that really helped me was something that I had heard on one of your previous podcasts where I forget who the guest was, but the bit of advice was don't approach the whole process of applying. Don't consider it one big gargantuan monumental task that needs to be overcome. For me, just it seemed, you know, the whole process, the whole thought of applying to business school while juggling a full-time job and family responsibilities, it seemed so overwhelming that I just kept putting it off for years and years and years. And on that particular podcast, you and your guests had said, look, don't approach it that way. Just break it up into small pieces. You know, open up your create your online applicant profile, fill out some basic biographical data, save it, you know, put it away for a couple of days, schedule a phone call with the friendly admissions staff, you know, learn more about the program, go back to your applications, you know, contact your colleges, get the transcripts, et cetera. When you break it up into small pieces and you compartmentalize it like that, the application just kind of takes care of itself. So my bit of advice is don't let it seem more overwhelming than it is. Break it up, make it manageable, and that'll get done. Now, that being said, with the reality of COVID and all the delays and getting a lot of this information, I wouldn't wait too long. I wouldn't take your time, because you have to factor in, you know, in 2020 and 2021, what would have taken 2 weeks previously may take 3 weeks in terms of reaching out to previous supervisors to get a letter of recommendation. A lot of people aren't working in the office. They're working from home, only checking their voicemail a couple times a day. So you may want to factor in that additional 20% lag in terms of getting a lot of the stuff that's required for the application. So I wouldn't be too lackadaisical about that. The other bit of advice I'd like to give, unique to my situation, is that when I started entertaining the possibility of getting an executive MBA, I made the mistake of asking too many people for their opinion. I asked a lot of my doctor colleagues at work and a lot of my doctor friends outside of work and my non-medical friends and family. And I think I was naively expecting that all of them would unanimously validate my decision. And they say, absolutely, this is the perfect thing for you to do. We support you 100%. I got a variety of different opinions. A lot of people said, why on earth would you want to do that? People said, it's a great decision. You should absolutely do it. You know, you'd be perfect for business school. And so because I didn't have one unified response from all these people I'd asked, it just confused me more. What I would say to applicants is, look, if you're still kind of weighing out, trying to figure out if this is right for you, pick a small group of people you trust. Pick some colleagues at work, pick some friends, pick some family, pick the people who you know have your best interests in mind, and let that be your benchmark. Just if you, the more cooks in the kitchen, the more confusing it's going to get. So just, you know, just don't complicate it anymore than you have to. And if it feels like the right decision for you, you know, don't let anyone else talk you out of it.
Both good pieces of advice, Perry. I really love the point about sort of incrementalizing the application. You don't have to do it all in one sitting. You certainly can, but we know how busy our applicants are. And we really tried to focus on what's essential for the purposes of the application process. And the application itself, just an initial introduction to who you are and your story. The interview really helps us sort of flesh that out. And so probably our favorite part of the application process. And such a good point about asking for advice. There's a part, you know yourself really well, those people who are trusted advisors in your circle, that's probably the group to start with, because of course, everyone, it's very easy to give an opinion on something. What do you think? But they're, you know, and it can create some confusion or apprehension, but if you're listening to yourself through this process, that's a good way to go.
And I'll tell you, Brett, I'd like to speak to the doctors or people from the medical profession that may be interested in doing this. I found that it was very interesting when I asked a lot of my physician friends and colleagues, most of them would say, why on earth would you want to go back to school after having been in school for so many years, right? For me to get to the point of being a neuroradiologist, I had to go to 4 years of college, 4 years of medical school, and then another 7 years beyond that. But you know, and this applies to anyone that's even been to law school or something. You know, if you even if you already have a secondary degree, don't let that be a reason to not pursue another degree, right? I just let that discourage. I said, why on earth would I want to do this? But I'm so glad that I didn't succumb to that pressure to not do it. And also, I'd like to speak to the people in the applicant pool that that are over the age of 40. Do not let that be a deterrent. Let me tell you something. There's, you know, the average age of the class, I believe, well, you know, Brett, is it what, 38 or 39?
It's actually 34.
It's 34, okay. Yeah. 34. But still, I'll tell you, I feel as youthful as ever. You know, I'm not over the hill, you know, and don't let that 40 or even 50 number deter you. You know, there's still plenty of time to really make the most use of this experience. And I know for a lot of people, once they hit 40 or 50, they say, okay, well, what's the point? That should not be a factor whatsoever.
Well, Perry, it's always a pleasure speaking with you. I appreciate your candor, your vulnerability, your openness during this conversation. So much good information shared. And that was my interview with Perry Canarian, a first-year student in our Executive MBA class of 2022. As always, if you have any comments, suggestions, requests, anything you'd like for us to cover here on the podcast, we're all ears. We can be reached at exec, that's EXEC, MBA, at darden.virginia.edu. Until next time, stay safe, be well, and thanks for listening.